Welcome to the Thriving Farmer Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Kilpatrick. Our mission is to inspire, educate, and celebrate sustainable farming. We believe that you can build a profitable, sustainable farm that gives you true farm freedom. Join us as we talk to farmers, innovators, educators, and entrepreneurs to glean their top takeaways in business and life. Hey, Thriving Farmers, Michael Kilpatrick here with yet another episode of the Thriving Farmer Podcast. So today joining me is Jackson Holt, who is the owner-operator of Phoenix Farm, a small operation just outside city limits of Greensboro, North Carolina, where he grows a mix of vegetables with emphasis on carrots, primarily for a local farmer's market. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Michael. It's an honor to be here.
So Jackson, we've actually been in touch for a number of years. I forget how we kind of met.
It was through your small farm university, actually.
Okay.
I definitely heard about you and knew about your bubbler and greens course and things like that. But yeah, I've been in the small farm university for a couple of years now.
Awesome. Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about what got you into farming.
So I did study horticulture at NC State, but farming wasn't on my radar at all then. I was encouraged by my advisor to get some experience, even if we didn't think it would be something we would be interested in. And so the final summer before I graduated, I knew somebody who knew somebody who had a small, diverse farming operation, and so I volunteered a couple of days a week and fell in love with it there. But farming, it wasn't on my radar at all. I think it just kind of fell in my lap, like most great things and opportunities I've had in my life.
Yeah. So when you were working at that farm, what were the kinds of tasks that you were doing with them?
All different kinds of things. They were much more diverse than I am. I'm strictly a vegetable operation.
Okay.
They were doing like 2.5 acres of vegetables, a lot of plastic culture, tractors. And then we also had, I don't know, a dozen 15 head of cattle. We have a few hogs and broilers and 250 layer hens. So I got to sample all kinds of stuff there. So that was a great and exciting place to be romanced into the
farm. Yeah. I mean, good exchange of different tasks and all that goes into it. Yeah. So let's see, when you started your operation, kind of what was your goal and what was your vision?
I'm still working on that, to be totally honest. I just fell in love with getting connected to my food through that experience. It was totally new to me, and just being outside. I think I realized that was kind of the third job that I was fortunate to have working outdoors. Actually worked a couple summers as a on a commercial salmon fishing crew in Alaska. Summers, and I worked one, had a buddy of mine from high school invited me out one summer to work on a cattle ranch in Colorado that was over 100,000 acres and had bison and many thousands of head of cattle, and they did everything on horseback. And so I think just having had those experiences and then having that summer working on the farm just made me realize how much I loved working outdoors and growing food and bringing food to people and connecting to people in the community and, you know, feeling like the work that I was doing was meaningful. Yeah, I think when I was in college, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had a lot of anxiety around that and picked horticulture because I wanted to be as far away from a cubicle as possible.
Gotcha. So what would you say, you know, your habits, because obviously starting a small farm, running it by yourself is challenging. How do you stay organized on the farm?
Yeah, I think I'm not always perfectly organized. but one thing that I do most of the time, at least on the productive days, I've noticed are the ones that I take the 5 to 10 minutes in the morning to jot down anything and everything I can think of that I want to do that day, but even tasks that are rolling around in my mind and stressing me out and bothering me, just to get them out, get them on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then I simply just, you know, I go through everything that I can think of to do, including if it's a grocery run or anything like that. I don't really separate home life and farm life in that way. So just anything that I can think of, and then simply number them in a logical order of what kind of makes sense to do in terms of priority mainly priority. But sometimes it might be, you know, if I'm over on this area of the farm, then I might go ahead and do this quick little
thing. Yeah. So then is this all pen and paper?
Five kind of thing. Index card, 3x5 index card. I started out using paper, and I found that if I was walking by overhead irrigation, or if I was sweating, or if it was rainy that day, they would, you know, just immediately disintegrate if it was index card. So yeah, that's what I use.
All right. So let's talk about like the systems of your farm. So kind of, I know you do a lot of no-till.
Yeah. I'm working in that direction. I've seen the benefits, and it's been helpful. So I really like tarps. They really help weeds.
Yep.
To manage weeds, use some landscape fabric, but then I also do a lot of direct sown stuff, so I'm not able to use plastic or landscape fabric there. So, but I think going back and forth between those crops helps to kind of maintain control of the weeds. And then I also like the top dress compost. Originally got that idea years ago from Elliot Coleman, you know, just spreading out, you know, maybe just a half inch of compost, but evenly spreading it out, making sure all the soil is covered, helps to control weeds, and then also helps, you know, maintain the soil moisture and, and add fertility.
So you use a lot of compost then?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I'm really, really fortunate. When we bought this house in 2018 and this land, my wife and I had no idea that we were less than 10 minutes down the road from Greensboro's municipal compost facility. So they actually make a really nice compost that's a mix of mostly Ramiel wood chips, you know, because it's mostly from them clearing power lines and things, along with, you know, folks' yard waste, which includes grass clippings, you know, get that good nitrogen.
Yeah.
And obviously lots and lots of leaves that they shred up, but you know, they temperature monitor it to get out weed seeds and pathogens and stuff, because the city is concerned with that. So, and it's only $20 a ton, so I can put flatbed trailer down, or I can hire a neighbor and pay him $100 to bring his triaxle and just dump it.
Yeah.
They also have shredded leaves that are free, and it's partially composted. So that's an excellent path mulch. So path mulch and weed control. And they have wood chips, which I haven't done, but have considered experimenting some more with that, because those are free as well from the city. So that's an incredible resource to have.
Yeah, no, that is. That's like a gold mine for you.
Yeah.
Right now we are struggling. We had some initial success bringing in wood chips, and the town next to us brought us some leaves, but compost is not necessarily. There's a couple places that produce it, but the cities that produce it will only deliver to inside of their own zip code, and you can't like go in there with a truck. It's only for the people that are in there. And then like there's a couple commercial locations, but they're relatively expensive. So we're still trying to figure out that aspect of things, especially because we're on such a sandy soil, and it's not super sandy, but it's definitely a sandy loam, which on one aspect is great because it dries out really quickly. And we're actually, we're having our friend Matt Lebeau from the Kansas City area St. Louis area, do the foodscaping around the whole property. Mm-hmm. And so he's doing around the house with him foodscaping around the entire property. All the hedgerows and stuff like that are going to be food or profitable products coming out of them, like, you know, willow and that kind of stuff. But he was also talking to me about the, I don't know if you've seen the citrus and the snow folks, which are kind of like the half buried greenhouses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And the Chinese greenhouses. So I've obviously been out to, we've had Curtis Millsap on the podcast who talks about the Chinese greenhouses. And he was like, yeah, you really should do something like that. And I was like, well, actually, we totally could because of how sandy we are. So that's the advantage. But the disadvantage is it's hard to keep that organic matter in our CEC is relatively low.
Right, right. Yeah, I have this a similar issue. My soil is quite sandy, which blew my mind when I found this property and saw the soil. I grew up on the other side of Greensboro and had mm-hmm. this sort of sandy strip over here existed. But yeah, I've got folks across the street doing conventional corn and soy and tobacco, and you know, they till, you know, just hundreds of acres, dozens of acres at least, you know, and in the springtime, you can see it's just white sand.
Yes.
It was very, very different from the North Carolina red clay that I thought was more ubiquitous.
Yeah, exactly. So because of the sandiness of the soil, you do grow a lot of carrots. Do you want to talk about carrots?
Yeah. The sand is definitely conducive to grow on root vegetables. What do you want to know? I guess, I grew more carrots this year than I've grown ever. I have a very small operation. It's, less, just under 4/10 of an acre. So it's, 40 beds, 100 foot long, 30 inch wide. Raised beds. I use a BCS to build those up and a shovel, and then hand spread a lot of compost and things. I do a big planting in the late summer. I usually aim for like the last week of August.
Okay. And what zone are you in considered?
7B here.
7B. Okay. Yep.
So I aim for the last week of August, and then that has them sizing up by the end of October, and then just all through the winter, they just will hang out. You know, they'll size up just enough and then just get sweeter and sweeter as the cold weather comes in. And actually didn't even bother with any row cover this year. You know, I let the tops get bad and just kind of moved from bunching after the first 5 weeks or so to just taking the tops off and washing them and selling them loose or in bags without the tops.
So let's talk varieties.
Yeah. So I know you're a big fan of Bolero, and
well, I've had a hard time being convinced not to be. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I still play around. I usually have one bed or so where I'll grow 3 to 5 different either new varieties or old varieties that I just want to experiment with again, just to
make. Okay. It, yep.
You know, season to season, it's not something that I did off and just. And I don't want to be too quick to write varieties off. I'm a huge Napoli fan. I know that probably not as heavy, as high, but as the Bolero. But so that's my bread and butter is the Napoli. It does great overwintering and just hanging out in the soil and not having a lot of problems.
So do you ever get any of the sponginess at the top from the freeze-thaw, or you just don't get the cold?
Occasionally, but I usually only get that if I let them hang out into the late winter, early spring, like in March.
Yeah.
I've dug them before from that type of planting into April and May, and I definitely have lots of that issue, but probably I have it less than you because I don't have quite as much freeze thaw and
yeah.
And I always have the option of covering if I want to.
Now, do you feel that that's affected by a raised bed versus a flat bed, or do you think that's just the freeze thaw? And do you do any hilling?
I always, it always seemed to me like it was it was at the top. I just felt like it was when we had lots of cold weather and they had been exposed to that for a long time, that, you know, the frost was just essentially killing the top of the carrot. At least that's what was happening in my mind. I don't know if it's freezing, thawing, or just the fact that they're being exposed to freezing temperatures so much. And that's, you know, bursting the cells in the carrot.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what it is. Have you done any, hilling? Do you hill your carrots at all?
I don't. No.
Yeah. That's something I've been looking into because, obviously we do a big harvest in the fall, but we ended up having a few more than I felt we would need. So I left them out there just again, to see what they do and didn't protect them in any way. And I mean, the quality is still good, but you get right at the top, it's still starting to break apart a little bit. So, the quality is starting to go down. All right. So let's talk about soil prep for them. Do you have a specific, do you do anything before carrots, to get them to look the way they do or to get the fertility up?
Yeah. I've two of the five, my farms divide up into five blocks of eight beds. Two of which I got in for the first time this year. And so, I did work those beds up. I did a single initial tillage. That's hopefully the last one. And I mixed in lots and lots of compost. And then in the future, I don't plan to mix as much down into the bed, just top dress.
Okay.
And maybe broad fork, if I need to. But, so this year, the beds that I was growing carrots in had actually been tilled. And then I used a rotary plow to throw the soil up and build up the beds, and top dress with the half inch of compost.
Now, do you feel like you need to, with the sandiness, do you feel like you need to have raised beds?
Maybe not. But it, you know, it's hard to say. I feel like most of the time it's not necessary, but if it's ever necessary, then, you know, it's problematic if they're not. And so I do think I do more watering, of course, than I would otherwise, if I didn't have those raised beds. I was inspired by another farmer recently that I want to experiment with filling up my paths, which are look like a, quite a trough due to the bed, just essentially filling that up with wood chips and or shredded leaf.
Yes. Yeah. So like a permanent, yeah. And there's so many advantages for that. Obviously there could be a couple disadvantages, let's say things like slugs or, okay, so where exactly is the edge? And if you don't define that edge well, when you're tilling, if you do till, you have the chance of actually pulling wood chips into the bed. And that's obviously not very good. But yeah, it's one of those things that I would love to play with it. And obviously if you, and again, I think some of the problems is a lot of the equipment that we need as small farmers. I mean, the advances in the last decade, 15 years has been incredible. I cannot dispute that. It's incredible what's come out on the market, but some of the new advances that need to be done or could be done, there's going to be some really cool things I think that will come. And so, I mean, yeah, I'm just sitting here thinking like, you know, if you're trying to do that, if you could have like, let's say coulters on either side of whatever you're doing, your tilling. So it's basically giving that really nice clean cut and not sucking things in and out. That might do a good job of keeping those wood chips back a little bit, but yeah, it's, there's lots of things about and in these systems and like, and the other thing too, is that would hold in a lot of moisture too for you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So like you still get the effect, and I got to see this in person, and I know lots of people do this, but I got to see it from somebody here, nearby and is having really great success with it. And they're doing no-till.
Yeah.
And it's, you get the same sort of drainage effect. It's like a giant sponge that just soaks it up, but it keeps it from becoming runoff, washing your soil away. Mm. And it's a continual supply of nutrients.
Yeah. And carrots don't tend to run as far for nutrients, but if let's say you're moving into any of the fruiting crops or even like that, that sort of thing would just go right in there and suck all those nutrients out. Right. Would be really cool.
I've had tomatoes that grew like through their bed, across the path, into the other bed, and going into the next bed path beyond that. So it's but even that farmer that I was referencing, they came out to my farm and he scratched the edge of my carrot beds and said, "Look at those root hairs." He's like, "They're growing out to there and they're stopping." So
yeah.
They might not be necessary. I still have nice carrots, but it's exciting to think about what the potential benefit beyond my current success would be.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about germination, because I know that's something that people struggle with. What do you find works well to make sure you have consistent germination, especially in your heat?
Germinating carrots in August is... It takes some attention to detail. In short, my answer would be water, water, water.
Okay.
Like the first week, if it's really hot, and it almost always is into August, I'm watering 2 to 3 times a day at least, for at least 40 minutes per interval. So,
okay,
around 3 hours a day in my sandy soil in my raised beds.
And then what?
I can scale that back. I can sort of scale that watering back significantly after the first week. I can scale it back to 1 or 2 times a day the second week, and then once I'm into the third week, you know, even though the carrots have barely, you know, popped up and are maybe only 1 inch tall, their tap root is several inches deep, so they're able to access moisture even if the surface is dry. So
yes,
those first few days, that first week is just super critical. I mean, you think about when you look at those little carrot seeds in your hand and you think about how small they are and how vulnerable they would just be to being baked in the August, September sun. So, and then I think that top dress of compost really helps too. It kind of acts as a mulch to just a little bit to help hold that moisture in. But yeah, lots of water. I use the mega nets.
Okay.
So I'm able to water 8 beds with just a single line.
Yep.
Like five heads. I use the green heads.
Yep.
So that's amazingly simple, you know, just to run a single line, 5 heads, I can easily pull them out.
Yes.
Use those little blue stake SuperNet Juniors. And I still use those occasionally for things, but for doing a whole block at one time, it's hard to beat those mega nets if you've got the pressure and volume that you need, which is important to pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you don't use any tarps or anything or row cover to get the germination. It's strictly just irrigation.
Yeah. Strictly.
Okay.
I thought about, I know folks have done that successfully, putting the white side of the tarp up. And some people swear by that, but I've been getting good results. So I try not to.
Well, it's just one more thing to have to deal with.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm pretty much running things by myself. So the tarps are a tricky thing to do without a couple of people.
That's the truth. Yeah, that's absolutely true. All right. So let's talk. We've got them germinated. They're up about 1 inch. What's your cultivation look like?
I do very little cultivation, at least so far. I've been blown away with the effectiveness of the weed control, and and I will sometimes, you know, if I've got the time, I like to pull the tarp off and either irrigate or just leave it for a little while and let a few weeds sprout, what little weed seeds there are, and then cover it back up, and then I'm able to remove it. I've got, you know, just developing that stale seed bed ahead of time, I think is the most crucial and helpful thing that you can do, so that you don't have to do so much cultivation. So I do a little bit of hand weeding. I've experimented with different rows. I've gone anywhere over the years. I've done anywhere from 3 to 8 rows of carrots per bed. I've kind of lately settled on 4. And I sort of anticipated that I would be doing some scuffle hoeing in between, but it wasn't even necessary with the combination of the tarps and the compost, and getting that seed bed ready. It's just, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, what would you say the number of rows per bed that you've settled on? I mean, because you've done so many different ones. Is there one that you're like, if you want to produce baby carrots, you should be at this? If you want to produce big bunch, if you want to go for maximum yield?
I really like 4.
Okay.
Having an even number keeps you from reaching all the way to the very middle to harvest. I don't, because I have nice loose soil, I don't dig at all. So that means I am pulling carrots out a lot. And so I like having the 4 rows. It's just, it's simpler. And really I've found they're real forgiving in, as long as you've got the right overall density, I've find they're pretty adaptive in terms of like you. So that to say, you could go 2 or 3 rows. I would never go to 2, I don't think, but and just sow them more densely, in row spacing, versus you could have more row, but then you'd probably want to thin them. But I don't like thinning.
Yeah, no one likes thinning carrots. I think so many people, because they don't have a proper seeder, they end up doing some thinning. Or the other problem is because they don't have the proper weed control, they have to thin because there's so many weeds, they don't get any decent carrots because there's so many weeds. Mm-hmm. So talk to me a little bit about that. What are you seeding with?
Jang.
Okay.
Jang. I don't know what the correct pronunciation is, but...
The yellow one.
The yellow one. Do you actually, I was wondering about this as I was making notes. I remember hearing from somebody sort of the story behind developing it. I want to say it was something to do with the like the South Korean government sort of initiating the project to develop it. Are you familiar with that or?
I am not, but you're right. That's the area, the country, the world it came from. And there's been multiple knockoffs because obviously the Chinese have knocked it off a couple different times. And the first knockoffs were no good, but the recent ones have actually been kind of good. I was thinking of ordering a few just to kind of try it out and see what was going on with them. But yeah, I mean, it really is the best seeder. I mean, someone actually on the listserv was asking about this. There's this Ukrainian seeder, which is like a 5 row. And they were asking like, oh, it's great. And I was like, look, if you want to be serious about it, don't try to go cheap on a seeder, because if you buy the right seeder, it's going to make a massive difference in your farm business. Now, for like Jang, the thing between going like single row, multiple rows, or actually going to basically independent rows, that's a huge another discussion and cost right there. But just the basic 1 row is going to really change your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I have, the single row JP1.
Yeah. Now, have you done any splitting the rows of carrots, or doing like a double band or a band of carrots instead of a single row?
I've thought about that. I've been tempted, and I may experiment with that in the future. But what I'm doing now is working. But I do think in the next year or two, mm-hmm. I'll find that double row band. For the Jang, that looks really exciting to me. I think that would really help with being able to still have a nice dense sowing, but not have them on top of each other, so I do find that I occasionally end up thinning because I'd rather sow too thickly and do a tiny bit of thinning rather
than,
have too much ground exposed and have weeds and more cultivation to deal with.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things we've been playing around is with the Tillmore Power Ox. And originally I thought I was going to set it up wide and then do a multiple row basket weed behind it. And that failed miserably. And the reason for that is the machine's not heavy enough to pull a 3 row basket. It just doesn't work. The physics don't work. So we switched it back. They came down, switched it out to just do the small skinny tires and a 1 row basket, which did incredibly well. I mean, it blew my mind just how well it does. But the problem is it's really set up for 15 inch rows. And so that's where putting two rows of carrots on top of a 30 inch bed and then just sowing it like a double row would actually work out real well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it still gives you a massive amount of bare soil in the center there, which is not ideal, but it can work.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, while we're on the Jang topic, I do want to mention to folks, if, I mean, a lot of people are know what they're doing, but I do think it's important to pay attention to seed size.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about varieties, Napoli is my favorite orange variety, but I grow lots of others too. I grow red and purple and yellow. I like Gold Nugget and Purple 68 and Malbec, which has been in short supply, but there's other good red ones. I don't like white carrots. As a side note, I think they're delicious. They grow really fast. They're
beautiful, yeah,
but people are weirded out. Like they think they're a parsnip every time.
They're hard to get clean sometimes because they're white.
And if you have just the tiniest amount of dirt or, you know, bug damage or anything, it just
yeah,
you know, it's like it screams I'm damaged or I'm dirty.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't do white carrots, even though I think they're great. I think they
look
good and they grow fast. What was I talking about? The Jang, yeah, the carrots. So the seed size can vary so much. So it's important to, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, what do you use for carrot seed? Like what roller do you use? And I'm like, well, it depends on what carrot variety you're going with. You know, they can be, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 times, you know.
Well, I think, you know, I don't know if I told you the story of this last fall. I ordered in some brand new Bolero seed from Johnny's. And what they neglected to tell everybody is that particular lot was literally 4 to 6 times bigger than any other Bolero seed I'd ever seen. It was massive. Yeah. And so trying to put it through any seeder was just, I mean, first, if you weren't paying attention, you literally kind of screwed yourself because you literally was putting out a seed every 3 inches instead of, you know, like the 30 seeds you want per foot. So, but yeah, I mean, you really just have to look at it and you're right. It's not like what roller, it's like, what's the size of the seed? And then actually you need to run the roller and sit there and calibrate it. And, you know, that's something that it's a nice winter afternoon is just when your seed comes in to go ahead and just sit there and calibrate it to, what the current seed sizes are.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't always take the time to get as finely tuned as you do. I've seen some of your videos on calibrating and it's awesome. I typically, my sort of litmus test is just like sprinkling a little bit into the bottom of the hopper.
Yeah.
You'll see the roller and make sure it's, you know, grabbing.
Yep.
Seeds per hole.
Well, yes, you're right. There is, I mean, the thing is when you're seeding a third of an acre, you have to get a little bit more exact than, than that. But you're right. Yeah. It's just one of those things. And the thing is like too, is yeah, you can do all of that, but if you don't do all the other things you just talked about, which is like water and cultivation and the right fertility, then there's so many things that have to go right to get a good crop of carrots.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about like, when are you starting the harvest?
When do I start harvesting the carrots?
Yes.
So I sow them into August, and then they're ready late October, and then I harvest them until I sell them all.
Okay.
So, I mean, they would go into the spring, and I've done that before. And if, you know, once it starts to get warm, you do start to have issues. At the old farm, we'd call them floaties. You know, you talked about these thaw damage. One of the tests you can do is dumping them in a tub of water, and the ones that float up are going to be the ones that have that are not good anymore. So you want them to sink. I haven't had to do that at all lately, just because the demand has been so high.
Yeah,
I sold them all by early January this year, and. Since then, I've basically kind of been on cruise from the waiting for a couple more weeks to sow carrots in the green, or sorry, tomato seedlings.
Yep.
Thing in the greenhouse, and then we'll be off to the races. But
I like to have
the downtime in the winter, anyways. So So
yeah, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about that, like the cycle of the year, because obviously, you know, you're far enough south that you can do quite the amount in the wintertime, but you do choose to kind of take it a little bit easy. And why do you feel that's important?
I just like the time to be able to reflect on the year and think about my ever-changing vision for the farm and how it fits into my life and my family's life. My wife works full time. She's a ER nurse, and we have a 2-year-old, and so we share, you know, responsibilities for taking care of her, and we like to do, I like to do other things than just farming. I love farming, and I'm glad that it's my job.
Yeah,
but I also like fly fishing and hunting and camping and hiking and canoeing and, you know, all kinds of things, and just spending time with family and, you know, taking the little one to the park or whatever. So that's been one of the biggest challenges, I think, is for me, is figuring out how to have a productive farm and keep it from, you know, sucking all your life force away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that's actually one of the things I think that's most unique about my farm is that it's not all totally all consuming. I do most of my farming in about 3 to 4 days a week, plus a farmer's market on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority I do the 2 days that our daughter's in daycare. So, I try to limit what the farm takes from me in terms of time, especially. And, you know, I want my daughter and my wife to have positive experiences of the farm and not have it be something that's always, you know, pulling dad away and not enriching family life. So I'm in a very, you know, fortunate, privileged position with my wife having a full-time job that she can support us, and I can invest a lot of the money back into the farm and be able to dream about, you know, how much do we want the farm to be.
So the farm is profitable, but it doesn't have to be your full income and provide the health insurance and that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Hey, Thriving Farmers. Have you checked us out on YouTube lately? We have a bunch of new content there, including a few rants by me. I want to tell you, you don't want to miss them. I actually go rant about, you know, some of the problems I see in our space and some of the challenges I see farmers facing. So go check that out. We've got instructional videos over there as well. Talk about setting up our new farm here in Ohio and all the steps we're going to do that, as well as just tutorials and tips on best practices for all sorts of things on the farm. So go ahead, check over at Growing Farmers on YouTube and see the new content we put together for you. So if there was, let's say, a magic reset button to go back, what system would you go back and put in place sooner rather than later?
I think tarps. I wish.
Okay.
I'd never been a long time and kind of learned the nuances of them. Like, they've been such a game changer. So maybe that in terms of a one word answer. But I think also, again, hearkening back to the number of hours that I let the farm, when I started out, you know, and it was fine, it was different. I was not even married and didn't have any kids.
Yeah.
I could go out to the greenhouse at 11 or midnight and turn the light on, and so the tomato seedlings
was bringing. Yes.
And I didn't mind that, but now I think if I had practiced more limiting what the farm took, it would have forced me to be innovative and figure out bottlenecks and and all those things that allow you to be more successful in the given time that you have.
Yeah. It puts the blinders on, the parameters on. And I think two of the things is because you have less hours to spend on it, it means you're going to do things a little bit slower. Mm-hmm. And when you do things slower, it has more time to think, because you're doing these other not menial tasks, but they're not a lot of, sometimes they're, you know, more the house rote tasks, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And the rote task to me is the washing of the bins, the washing dishes, the taking the trash out to the street, that kind of stuff. And because it doesn't require a lot of mental taxing, it allows you, your mind to just go. And when your mind can go other places and think back to other things of the farm, it allows you to really start thinking through some of these bottlenecks and to give you more efficiencies.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's why the best ideas come to us in the shower, right?
So yes.
We don't have to think about showering.
Yeah. You just stand there underneath that hot water.
I think the same thing happens for me when I'm bunching carrots too. You know,
yeah.
Getting the rhythm, you're just doing it.
And yeah.
Experiencing flow, I think is what
they Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you said you don't have a team then. Most of the work's done by yourself.
Well, up until November of last year of 2020, that was true. It was just me, with exception of a very occasional volunteer who just wanted to get their hands in the dirt. And but in November, I I had been harvesting for a few weeks on these carrots, and I was like, this is a lot of carrots, and
yeah,
you can help with this. And I brought a couple of friends over, and they came out a couple of days a week for several hours and just helped me mostly harvest carrots, harvest, wash, and pack carrots. And I knew this would be the case, but
yeah,
having that experience was just, it was mind blowing. Like realizing that I had the freedom to not only could I harvest so much more quickly, and even start to do some wholesaling, but I could step away and work was still getting done, and that was a nice feeling to realize.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, what it does too is that it not only frees you up from some of the hand aspect there, because you've time to start working in other parts of the business. Mm-hmm. It allows you to just give more flexibility too. So you can all go bunch carrots, or they can bunch carrots and you can, fill the sinks up, or, you know, the different aspects of things. So it's more of a process now too, instead of.
I was able to sort of float around, like in that specific example of the carrots, I was able to float around and just stop the bottlenecks from, okay, that water's dirty. Cause sometimes I'll take the carrots as we bunch them, you know, put a dozen or so in a tote with water so that the dirt's nice and soft and it washes off super, super easily.
A pre-soak.
So being able to cycle out that pre-soak water and then cycle out the water to clean the greens off after the bunches are clean, to get a super clean, nice product. Mm-hmm. And so, just making sure everything is humming along. So I had them like November, December, and into the beginning of January, and I plan to continue that this year in as much capacity as I feel like my cash flow will allow. Just because I've seen how much of a game changer, and it's just so much more fun not to be by yourself all the time. I'm an introvert, and so I enjoy being alone. But
yeah.
But also, like, you know, living at home and working at home, especially during the COVID age, it's a great way to be around other people outside, you know, breathing fresh air. So, excited for 2021, for Phoenix Farm this year. So,
yeah. So how many years have you been farming now?
So I've been working on farms since 2011. I ended up managing the farm where I worked at prior, for a couple of years as my boss sort of was getting out of the vegetable farming scene. And he was super, super generous in allowing me to use his land as he was getting out of it. Mm-hmm. His tractor, his greenhouse, his walk-in cooler, even his truck for a little while until I was able to get a cargo van. Just really helped me get experience using managing his farm, kind of seeing how that worked, and then letting me start Phoenix Farm, renting some land from him and using his resources. And but then so that was only a couple of years. So it's basically, I think it was 2016 I started my own thing officially. Yeah, so I started out on another land base, and then we've only been on this property since 2018.
Gotcha.
We moved in April of all times to move. So that was an interesting year. That was, and that, so that's another point. 2018, we bought a house in this property, got pregnant, had a baby. And so that was actually the only year that I think my gross revenue dipped. It's been growing, it's been increasing with the exception of that year every year. And every year I've been growing on less land than I did the year prior.
That's awesome. So more dollars per square foot.
Exciting trend that I hope continues. So,
yeah. So what advice would you go back and give yourself, you know, if from that first year, if you could?
I hate to sound like a broken record, but the only thing that keeps coming back into mind is focusing on efficiencies and limiting the time that I allow myself for farming. I don't know. It's hard to say, 'cause I really enjoyed those years and those seasons of working a lot and working long hours. But again, I think just, it would have projected, like, projected me forward to have more focus on efficiencies and allowing for sort of a whole more holistic kind of life balance, family life, and mm-hmm. for other things.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. What would you say that has your the range of crops you've grown over the years shrunk as you've gotten figured out what's better for you and your farm to grow?
Absolutely. Yes. And as I think just being on a smaller land base, you've got to really start to think more about dollars per square foot and how long the crops in the ground and all those types of things. So once we moved to this property, I was officially done with, it's always in the back of my mind to consider experimenting with different things, but I've ruled out winter squash.
Okay.
Sweet corn. I swore off okra years ago after I picked multiple 400 foot by myself. You know.
Yes.
So I love eating okra, but I don't know if I'll grow it for a long, long time.
Yeah. What's your favorite way to cook it?
Oh, just dump it on a baking sheet with olive oil and salt and just roast it in the oven.
Okay. I don't think I've done that method. I've only usually had it. Yeah. In things. Now it's interesting. Yeah. A sweet corn to me is one that I have a very, very hard time getting around just because it's such a poor producer. But you know, last year we actually did quite well with our winter squash after we ran the enterprise budget at the end of the year to the point that we're debating whether to redo it this year to actually plant some again this year, just because a lot of people ask me why, because even this is the first year, obviously, in this new farm and the first year with a farm stand. And I don't feel like we have the market share yet for multiple acres of all the mixed crops we have, but I do have the one outlet that will buy literally everything I can sell for winter squash at a very premium price.
That's great.
And so being able to have that allows me to say, okay, I can count on this, you know, $8,000 to $12,000 worth of income from this very specific thing. And the farmer will even come down and help us, you know, do the bed prep and all that, which is really nice.
Yeah. Winter squash for me was an easy one to swear off because I have a very clear
Yes.
A vivid memory of 1 year just having almost complete crop failure. And I thought that I had an amazing year. Like they just looked great. And then and I remember I think my wife and I were just married. And I think I remember feeling like I'd scared her a little bit. She's like ugly, angry side of me.
Yeah.
I was just cursing the wireworms or whatever bug it was that was drilling into them and just.
Oh, yes.
Harvest time.
So was it a bug that drilled in and then just pushes out frass?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We had that on 1 year, and it was on only the very specific type of squash. It literally only hit the one type. It was that one from, I think, High Mowing. It's incredibly resilient. The vines are 40 feet long. It's really black and really like bumpy. I forget the variety of it, but it only hit that one, and it hit every single one.
Is it like a kabocha squash?
No, it wasn't. I forget what they call it, but yeah, it was just it devastated that. And I love that variety because literally, it was bulletproof otherwise. It did not get disease, but for some reason, I don't know if they fruit later and it just was at the right time for them to start drilling, but it was literally the only squash that got it. But I know exactly the pest you're talking about, and it's something that's more of a southern thing, and causes bigger problems for the more southern growers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know of a solution? Is there an Omri product that you know of or like for that, or you just haven't had that so much of an issue with that lately?
Yeah. So we didn't have it last year. Now here's the thing. I did look into that pest extensively because, one of the things we do in our small farm university is people can post pretty much anything in there. Mm-hmm. And so one time someone actually posted in there and like, I'm having problems with this worm. And can you, what's going on? How can you help? And so what I'll do at that point is identify the pest. And then I'll usually do a deep dive. And obviously I have some amazing resources here and then just through different friends. And so I did the research and literally there wasn't a ton that you could do for that. Does pickle worm sound like it's something that, does that sound like the worm?
Yeah, that does sound. And I definitely have that on my cucumbers sometimes.
Yes. But, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm looking at that right here and I believe that is pickle worm. And obviously I need to make sure, yes, it is pickle worm. Cause now I'm looking at the evidence of pickle worm feeding on squash here. And there's obviously, again, usually the extension is the best place for that. So I'll usually go through like 6 or 8 different extension things and then look at what the horticulture manuals are looking at. The preferred hosts, and the thing is too, is it's a very specific time frame in the year too. So if you can get it during that time frame and usually use a BT product on it, you can usually pretty good job. But the problem is they lay the eggs and then it travels very quickly into the squash. So unlike some of the worms that eat the outsider leaves, the leaves, which you can get pickle worms on the inside. And so it's almost like you have to inject the BT. And I don't think that's a preferred or B legal form of that. But the thing is rotation obviously is a big aspect of it. So as long as you can rotate the field, do not let any of the material from year to year or trash. And the other thing was row cover. So getting it row covered actually does work, but you have to row cover it for very specific times.
Now, when you say trash, do you mean any part of the entire plant or just the fruit?
Yeah, any part of the entire plant. So we like to get that turned under, get that back into the ground. There are some natural enemies like soldier beetle, but it's really hard to, make sure they're actually in the field. Mm-hmm. So, there are a couple insecticides, but the problem is like you're also trying to hit them at the same time you have pollinators in the field. And so you obviously do not want to hurt your pollinators because those are so things. There is some out there right now, there has been some results with the nematodes. So there is a nematode that can actually do a pretty good job. But it's also trying to find it and stuff like that. It's ineffective though for the open blossoms, like the cucumbers, because the nematodes do die quickly when exposed to sunlight. So, Yeah, that's just the problem. It's very hard to do that. So again, it comes back to row covers, but obviously if you're trying to pollinate, putting row covers on is very tough too. So, squash can be used as sometimes actually for pickleworm, they'll use squash as a trap crop. So because cantaloupe is actually one of the less preferred host for it. And so some of these southern, cantaloupe growers will actually use squash to kind of as a trap crop, but it's a tough worm. It's a tough worm. And what we found was just the row covers as late as possible and then just good rotation. But that's what I've got on pickleworm.
That's good.
Let's move a little bit to your marketing. So you've talked a little bit extensively about the farmer's market. You actually have a really good farmer's market.
Yeah. I sell at the Durham farmer's market. And there are actually markets closer to me now that we've moved out here. Mm-hmm. It was just really hard to say goodbye to Durham. We already had our foot in the door there and just, I really benefited because not only have I been there for years representing my farm, but I was representing the farm that I was at previously there. I was the main person representing that farm at Durham. So, probably 8 or 9 years there, people have been seeing my face and and some quality produce. And so we've developed relationships and some regular customers and it's just a really great market. So, and we're only, we're really fortunate here. Like when we moved, we actually moved farther away. We moved west away from the Durham market. But it was the same drive time. It's still a 40-minute drive because we're so close to the highway here. We're only a half mile from I-40. Mm. We're on a road that connects, I-40 and, Highway 70. And then that road is only a couple of miles long. So
yeah, that is nice. Really
convenient location. But yeah, we're only 10 minutes from downtown Greensboro. And there's some great markets there. So I don't know if I'm able to streamline things and having employees go as well and able to have the product, I might be
exploring yeah.
other markets. But for right now, take some good effort to meet the demand for the Durham market.
Yeah. Well, you have really, really awesome product too. And I think that's the one thing is that quality always sells.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And people know it when they see it, you can tell, limp lettuce or carrot, vibrant, shiny, delicious looking stuff.
So. Yeah. And it's interesting because I picked up a double door stainless fridge. I don't know if you saw the video I did of the new germ chamber we put together, but I picked that up from a guy and he does his own, a little bit of farming. And I was talking to him. He's like, what are you going to grow? And I was like, well, we do a lot of greens. He's like, well, you just can't sell greens around here. He's like, yeah, people just don't want to buy them. And then the next sentence was, well, yeah, I put them out by this on the road, but in our store, it's basically a little shed with open sides and everything like that. And he's like, it just wilts so fast. People don't want it. I'm like, absolutely. You've got to have the quality.
Yeah. If you're going to have them out at all, you better be there. They better be shaded and you better have a little mister. I really like, that's one tip. I think a lot of people, I just have the regular spray bottle, the hand pump.
Yeah.
With the, you have to squeeze it every time. I've got one that's, it might be a half gallon or something, but it's one of those continuous sprays. So you just pump it a few times.
Yep.
Got the little piston deal. So that's a game changer for, whether it's greens or root vegetables or whatever on a windy day or windy day, sitting out at market for a couple hours, that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, just keep misting it every 15 minutes or so and keep them looking nice and shiny. So if you could pick one, what would you be your favorite farming tool?
Well, we already talked about the Jang, so I would probably say it's a toss-up between irrigation timers and the green spinner that you helped me build through your video,
okay.
Figure it out. So Those are
automation.
Both a joy to use.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about simplifying. You got to do less on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. All right. So if folks want to find out more about you and follow your carrot journey there, where can they find more of you?
So I'm most active on Instagram, Phoenix Farm Online. I'm also on Facebook, phoenixfarmonline.com.
Okay.
So if anybody has any questions, they can reach out to me any of those places.
Yes. Yep. And your Instagram game is always fun to watch that, see what you guys are up to. And the Facebook too, you do a lot of pictures of carrots there too, which is great to see.
Yeah. I'm a little obsessed with carrots.
Yeah. We used to do yellow sun for a while. That was a great yellow carrot. And then I think they dropped it, unfortunately. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, in terms of eating quality, gold nugget just is, it's amazing. I mean, and it's not one you have to cook either for it to taste good. It's like,
yeah,
it's an ants type, versus, the more storage kind. So like it's, the flavor is almost as good as Napoli. So I generally tell people anything red or purple, I recommend, roasting it or cooking it somehow to bring out the sweetness. But yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate the time you took with us. And it's been fun watching you grow the farm over the last couple of years in the small farm university. So yeah.
Thanks. I owe a lot of my success to you. This small farm university has been a really helpful tool. Just having that Facebook group to just, snap a picture of a pest or whatever. Mm-hmm. Bunch of people eager to chime in on their experiences and how they deal with different problems. So
yeah, and the really cool thing too, because there's a lot of Facebook groups out there, but it's a Facebook group of people that are looking to build profitable, sustainable farm businesses. Mm-hmm. And there's a massive difference between that and someone who just wants to grow stuff. Because when you grow stuff, there's not a lot of investment of them. And you're not going to necessarily get a right answer. I mean, you just look at some of these threads, hundreds of people, and half the people have misidentified the pest.
Yeah.
And that's not good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, Jackson, well, thank you so much again. And again, yeah, you actually introduced me to the hibiscus too, which we actually grew this year and had a lot of fun with. So yeah. I appreciate that. It's fun to see how you have looked at crops and figured out how to, maximize the return on the small acreage.
Yeah. Yeah. How did that do for you?
We did really well. We loved it. They were a lot of fun. We got them in way too late. But we got a bushel or two off the row. The biggest problem obviously is peeling the husks. So, that was a little bit of a time challenge.
So did you peel it before you sold it?
Well, because we didn't have a sales outlet. We were just doing it for trial. Yes. So we ended up peeling it and drying it, and we put them all in the cabinet for us to use to make our own tea, which was, again, fabulous, a lot of fun. But yeah, and if we were going to sell it, we wouldn't peel it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And I even, I'll when I'm making myself tea, especially early in the season,
before
seeds have developed and it becomes more okra-like in terms of passing on some of that.
Yeah.
I'll often just boil them whole, and I'm not boiling them for very long. So I don't really.
Yeah. Then again, in efficiency. So let's say, in the long term, you wanted to just make tea out of it. Cause that's obviously one of the things we see is a profitable crop for us, is harvest them and then make our own tea for the farm stand and just have a big, big jug of that sitting in the farm stand and sell it by the glass. Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be possible just to, as long as you're picking them young, to never have to peel them?
Yeah, I do. You run the risk of it becoming a little bit more thick, a little bit more viscous.
Mm. Yeah.
In general, I don't mind just a little bit of that. So if
I'm
fairly careful with getting most of them young, again, especially early in the season, then I would say, yeah, I would say go for it. And then if you have a week where you're like, oh, this seems like a little thicker, you know, than I'd like for the, then you can start peeling from there on out. But
yeah,
it's like, it tastes like Kool-Aid without the sugar. I mean, obviously I typically sweeten it.
Yeah. Yeah, we put maple syrup in it, even though it's expensive. Well, again, Jackson, thanks so much. Appreciate your time. And can't wait for this there and share this with the audience.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye. Hey, thriving farmers. Join me next week as I interview Tim Peterson, who is the co-owner of Arizona Grass-Raised Beef. Tim ranches in Arizona. He runs multiple farms as well as a beef processing plant, and they do value adding with their beef broth and tallow ending up on stores and in customers' homes across the U.S. So join me next week to hear this fascinating conversation about vertically integrating your beef business. So there you have it, another episode in the books. So I'd love if you would hop on over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. Those mean everything to us. We love to hear what you're thinking. If you have a podcast guest that you can recommend, please pop on over to the Thriving Farmer Podcast website and leave us a review. That's thrivingfarmerpodcast.com.